Philippa Banyan, thanks so much for coming in.
Sure, happy to be here, Susan.
The percussion ensemble at Temple is doing George Antheil's Ballet Mécanique. What was your thinking about programming this piece?
It's a work that I had heard of for years. Colleagues had done it in various places around the country. And actually, it was prompted by our dean, who's a big fan of the piece, has always wanted to do it. And so we finally discussed, hey, you know, let's just put this down in the scheduling for the concerts this year, and let's just make this happen.
George Antheil is perhaps best known for this piece. It was done in the 1920s. It was rather unusual at the time. It's rather unusual now because it uses all sorts of different percussion instruments. It was originally written as a score for an avant-garde film, but I understand halfway through the filming and the composition, the filmmakers and the composer decided, well, we'll just keep it separate.
Right. Yeah, I don't think maybe it was a question of technology at the time, but they basically parted ways before the premiere. And so, you know, the film and the score have honestly little to do with each other in certain aspects. You're right in saying that this is what he's best known for, but I think he swore it off after about 1925 and didn't really touch it until, I guess, in the 50s when he did make this revised version, which we're performing.
He was born in 1900, so when he did this, he was in his early 20s. He had some Philadelphia connections because
right.
He had a patron, Mary Louise Curtis Bach, who would then found Curtis Institute of Music. I understand he also attended Settlement Music School and may never have graduated from high school or college, but was an extremely active composer, went to Europe, was caught up in the interest at the time of mechanical things and the post-industrial revolution and the effect on the arts as well as on the rest of the world.
Right, I think so. You know, he grew up in Trenton, so certainly Trenton was a very industrial city at the time. I think his father was a businessman, a shoe salesman. But I think he grew up with some of those sounds perhaps just around him as part of his environment. And so that's certainly what he was trying to do at the time in the 20s with his piano sonatas, you know, at the time were also very kind of mechanistic in a way. But, you know, it's interesting. He almost sort of backs off of that later in his life and talks about, well, the piece is not really supposed to portray any machine in and of itself. It's not supposed to be programmatic in a sense. Mm. It's just supposed to be ultimately musical, I think, was his goal. Yeah, it's certainly the form of the piece, the instrumentation, the bells, the propellers, all the percussion sounds. You know, it's written entirely for percussion instruments, pianos, keyboard percussion, and other battery instruments.
So. Well, so let's talk about that. It premiered in June of 1926 in Paris, and the original orchestration was for 16-player pianos, 2 regular pianos, 3 xylophones, 7 electric bells, propellers. That was airplane propellers, right?
I guess he says the sound of the propellers. I honestly don't know what they did for that original piece. I'm sure they didn't have airplanes up, you know. I think it was actually more of a salon concert in a large home there in Paris where the premiere took place. And so some people will do like some kind of a fan with leather straps and a board to sort of create the effect of a propeller sound.
Well, along with sirens, bass drums, a tam-tam, apparently, it was pretty cumbersome to do at the time with that orchestration. And in 1953, you mentioned that he reorchestrated it.
Right.
And that's the version you're doing. So what is it scored for, the version you're doing?
So the new version, the piano parts have been pared down to just simply 4 acoustic pianos. Player pianos were part of the original conception of the piece. And the rolls had to be punched and the player pianos had to be synchronized. And apparently that didn't go very well at the premiere performances. And then there was a riot at Carnegie when they tried to do it in New York a couple years later. and there was a riot at the original performance apparently too. But he says that was staged for some film in his book. But the new version, 4 pianos, 2 xylophones. So that's been pared down. And then bass drum, tenor drum. You've got 2 propellers, small and large. You've got 2 electric bells. There's actually no sirens, just bells and propellers. And then glockenspiel, and then some other drums and things in and out.
And are you using any recorded sound?
We will be. I think that's our solution for the bells and the propellers, is just to use sampled audio sounds, and then we'll just trigger those from a laptop or something like that. And we can control the volume very carefully in the space.
So how many musicians are you using?
We're using about 13 for this performance.
Now, you talked before about his comments about the piece and what it was really intended to do or say. Was it making a statement or telling any particular story or just exploring sound?
Yeah, I think every composer probably hopes to just explore sound and try to create, you know, something that is somewhat original. And so for him, you know, he kind of idolized Stravinsky at this point in his life, I think. And he's just trying to create some kind of stamp, some kind of mark, certainly, as a composer. And I guess he saw this sort of idea of machinery and mechanism. He saw that as his way in, so to speak. Yes, he did it with several of his piano sonatas, mechanisms, and Sonata Sauvage and other things written for his wife.
So was he writing according to classical form?
Not that I can tell, based on the score, no. As some of his works are somewhat of a loose sonata form, perhaps, but I do think form was important to him, and the form and the rhythm and the structure of the piece are really what holds the mechanique together, I think, more so than any sort of melodic or pitch material. It's basically, you know, the structure, the large structure of the piece in three parts. There are many time signature changes and tempo changes, and sometimes it's hard to make sense of from a traditional sort of, you know, analytical, theoretical viewpoint. But when you're just thinking about sort of these gestures rhythmically and within time and space and just trying to relate them to one another, it seems to make a bit more sense. But it's still very unique.
When you say the form and the structure and the rhythm hold it together, can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, well, apparently with this piece, he had this epiphany about what he calls a time-space formula. Apparently it was just that he was trying to relate everything, not by virtue of sort of vertical harmonies or sonorities, but according to sort of an innate space and their rhythmic relationship to one another. Apparently part of this formula was just the fact that he would use kind of an additive process in many of the sections where he's going from 2-8 to 3-8 to 4-8 to 5-8 to 6-7, just basically a numerical progression. I'm not sure what that did for him exactly, but it's certainly there in the form and in the structure. But he just, maybe perhaps like Beethoven, I think of Beethoven as a composer where, you know, the form sort of is paramount, even beyond any of the other revolutionary aspects. And you just sort of have a sense that, hey, this feels right, this feels good, this works. I think hopefully if we can pull this off the right way, we'll have a sense of, hey, this section just works, you know, the pacing, the drama, the energy, the rhythm just works musically. In and of itself, without any other additions from harmony or melody.
So if there's not an extra musical narrative, there is a kind of musical path,
yes,
that you follow.
I hope so, yeah. Trying to find the line, yeah, just throughout each section of the score, and just follow that line continuously through the piece as it sort of weaves in and out of the parts.
So what's the biggest challenge? Are you conducting it?
I am.
So what's the biggest challenge for you as a conductor, and what do you think the biggest challenge is for the musicians?
Right. I've been told by the musicians that thus far it's just the concentration aspect, especially for the two xylophone players. You know, they practice these passages, very difficult passages, you know, on their own or together, but then once they're in the midst of the large ensemble and things are just clipping along, just the rate of speed at which these events are occurring, I think, is difficult. And I imagine it's the same for the pianist. But for me as a conductor, I think it's really just gauging many of these tempo changes, and again, trying to pace them in a way that makes the rhythmic figures and the musical figures come off with the right kind of musical energy. So there's many of them, and there's tons of meter changes. I think, there's over 600 meter changes in the score. Directing traffic, so to speak, with this kind of an ensemble and holding everybody together, I think that'll obviously be my biggest challenge.
When music doesn't have an extra musical meaning or story, but it does tell its own story in terms of music, does it, in your mind, tap into certain emotions or feelings that help you guide you through it, either as a listener or as a musician?
Sure. I think sound affects each of us uniquely as humans. And certainly I think Antal, with these kinds of sounds, was trying to evoke perhaps a very different kind of reaction from his audiences. You mentioned the war in the industrial age, and I think a lot of the music of that period perhaps was reactionary to, you know, the First World War and sort of the state of affairs after that. So there's a certain coldness, perhaps, to it. There's a certain rigidity. There's kind of an emotional detachment, perhaps, in a way. But still, I find that, especially as performers, we're often so invested in the performance itself that we can't help but get emotionally attached to certain figures or phrases. And some of it's, you know, quite beautiful, almost Bartokian in ways, and some sections very mysterious. So I find it, you know, a fascinating piece, certainly fun to explore.
Any particular parts that intrigue you?
There's many parts where there's the whole ensemble playing, and it's fast, and it's loud, and it's ferocious, and very percussive. The parts that I find most intriguing are the ones that are most contrast to that. The sections that are a bit slower, that are much sparser in texture, that use more space and silence. And you get to hear just the individual tones and timbres of the various colors throughout the percussion orchestra.
When you say it's cold, or it can be cold, I was listening to a recording and thinking about how percussion isn't always melodic, but this is very melodic because it has a lot of the melodic instruments.
Right.
But there's something about rhythm that connects us intuitively. And I've talked to percussionists who talk about, you know, our heartbeat and the fact that we can get into this piece. Well, I found myself moving with it and tapping my foot and just
sure.
kind of just like enjoying that pulse.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, rhythm, you know, I think for any musician, but especially for a percussionist, rhythm is the foundational element of music. And, you know, without rhythm, can you have music? I don't know, but certainly with just rhythm, you can have music. So rhythm alone can be musical in and of itself. And so I think certainly this piece does that. It does a lot more than just the rhythm and the form as we've been discussing. It is a piece that percussionists love, and like a lot of rhythmic-based musics, other contemporary composers like Steve Reich, you know, uses rhythm in very different ways than Antheil, but still they're both rhythmic-based musics, and we as percussionists find them very satisfying, I think, to play and perform and just be in the midst of a large ensemble, you know, doing those kinds of works.
And you professionally have been an advocate for use of percussion in new music.
Sure. Yeah. I've commissioned some pieces over the last few years since I've been here at Temple. I've enjoyed working with groups in town such as Network for New Music and other ensembles, and obviously playing premieres with the orchestra and other groups in town. You know, I just think it's fun. It's always fun. I certainly think percussionists, we have a lot to say musically and artistically. And I think the more that we can get our message out there to broader audiences, I just think that's exciting.
What message?
The message that percussion is awesome. Percussion music is awesome. And you can build, honestly, you can build significant works just through the use of percussion instruments. And I think that's what we see with the Ballet Mécanique. You know, as early as 1924, you know, often people don't think of percussion-only music until later, maybe 31 with Varese's Ionization. And then, of course, the music of Steve Reich, who I mentioned later with drumming in 71. And we did music for 18 musicians here at Temple a couple years ago. But these kind of big, grand pieces where the percussionists are the violinists, so to speak. You know, we are front stage, center stage. I think it's definitely 20th, 21st century music. And it's just nice to have a place, you know, have a music where we can be not at the back of the stage, so to speak, but we can be up front and showing people what these instruments are capable of.
That's great. Thank you so much, Philip O'Banion.
Thank you, Susan.
We look forward to the performance of Ballet Mécanique.
Thank you.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.